This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
You've heard the news. Even the most conservative agencies say we have only a few years left to change course before climate change becomes unstoppable. But no, this is not another Radio EcoShock program of doom. Instead, we're going to look at one of several large-scale solutions available. In 2007, billionaire Richard Branson announced the Virgin Earth Challenge. He offered a $25 million prize to the best method to remove greenhouse gases from the atmosphere with no harmful impacts. Out of 2,600 submissions, Alan Savory and the Savory Institute survived to the current short list of 11 technologies to do it. Alan Savory. He was born in a country then known as Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. He's managed wild game as a biologist, and he's been a large-scale farmer. He became a politician in Africa, but left in protest against racism in his home country. In 2010, Savory's Operation Hope in Africa won the Buckminster Fuller Challenge. He moves between his base in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and the organization's big farm near Victoria Falls, deep in Zimbabwe. As you will hear, Alan Savory champions the need for big predators on Earth, from the wolves in Yellowstone to the lions in Africa. At age 76, he does not fear the wild. Alan Savory, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Good morning.
Alan, the United Nations and scientific bodies have released frightening maps of growing deserts, disappearing species, and a climate-damaged world. Why do you say these problems are all related?
Really, if you take a holistic worldview, and that's the way science is going increasingly from, you know, thinking of the world as in a reductionist manner, as we've done for hundreds of years or thousands of years, if you look at it holistically, let's take two of these, biodiversity loss and desertification. Desertification is the term used for land when it's drying up, etc., as rainfall becomes less effective, the available rainfall. Now, that cannot occur without biodiversity loss. So biodiversity loss, therefore, is the serious issue there, because if it doesn't occur, desertification simply does not occur. So we have a whole field of desertification with its own conferences and everything, and there's no tie to biodiversity. And likewise, we have a whole field of people concerned with biodiversity loss, mostly about charismatic species, unfortunately, and showing little recognition that this is, in fact, leading to desertification. And then if you look at climate change, if we look at desertification, the warming of soils, the loss of soil, all of the things that are happening with it, the less effective rainfall, the vast amount of rain or water that means that's going to lakes, oceans, etc., that should have been stored in soils. If we look at all of that and the carbon release plus the rest of agriculture, which is producing more eroding soil than food, then we realize that this is a major contributor to climate change. And even if we develop benign sources of energy for transport and cities and everything, totally benign energy, if we do not address agriculture, desertification, biodiversity loss, if we do not address these, climate change is likely to continue. So we have this extreme situation where these three, biodiversity loss, desertification, and climate change, need to be seen as one whole, as they are. At the moment, with mainstream science and these being regarded as three separate compartments, as it were, as you know, we've got mainstream scientists and media warning us that agriculture will have to adapt to climate change. No, damn it, it's causing climate change. And we've, as I said, got biodiversity loss being treated mostly as charismatic species and species we might discover for their commercial value, medicinal or whatever. So we really need to have a whole new look at this globally.
Well, let's drill down to a specific example. You have just returned from the Victoria Falls region of Zimbabwe, Africa. Tell us about your work there.
Well, what we're doing there is the same as we're doing in many countries. It's just that we have a very good example there because we actually own and manage the land, with a sister organization, Africa Center for Holistic Management, that I happen to be chairman of and formed, as well as the Savory Institute. So we work almost seamlessly. And there we're just putting into practice the management of the land, wildlife, and everything holistically. And it's very encouraging. That's what won the Buckminster Fuller Award last year and is getting increasing recognition. And if you ever visit it, or people visiting it, quickly see why. We've actually made the available rainfall more effective through increasing the livestock 400% above what it used to run 30 years ago. We've got a great increase in wildlife, and we now have the water or the rainfall so effective that we literally cannot keep pace with the production of the vegetation. Wildlife and everything's responding to it. And we have new open water, water lilies and fish in the river where we've not known it for 100 years in or more in the late dry season. That's after 8 months of no rain. So it's pretty dramatic.
Alan Savory, you've written a paper titled A Global Strategy for Addressing Global Climate Change. Everyone, I think, should read it because you turn many of our favorite ideas on their heads. For instance, tell us about the role of grass fires in climate change, say, compared to our cars.
Well, let me just, with the grass fires, illustrate it with one example. A few years ago, Marks and Spencer, the great shopping store in London, they announced the introduction of a carbon-neutral project which would cost £200 million. They were investing in it, and they said it would be the equivalent of taking 100,000 cars off the road per year. Now, that's a very fine effort, costing a lot of money. Now, if we look at the grassland fires in Africa, the United States, Australia, etc., we don't have to do much to match that. In fact, the last weekend I was, before I left Africa, I spent the weekend with our staff fighting a fire, and we saved a couple of thousand acres from burning, and that didn't cost us £200 million, but it did far more for global climate change than that £200 million will do in a year. The reason for this is a good French research some years ago showed that a 1.5 acre fire puts out more and more damaging pollutants than 4,000 cars per second. And of course, in Africa, we're burning over 2 billion acres every year. That's annual burning. So I think you see, just from that example, that we're completely missing the importance of the burning of grasslands. Everybody's focusing, and I'm not critical of it, they're focusing on the periodic burning of forests. But the grasslands are burning every year over billions of acres, and it's actually praised and supported by major environmental groups.
And then, Alan, some city dwellers in Western countries idealize a world of solar panels and vegetarians. And your vision is much earthier, involving big animals, even frightening predators like lions and wolves. Why do we need the predators and the animals?
Well, the way that we broke through with this, I started studying this problem of desertification. You know, that's all we could see in those days, 50-odd years ago, and I just couldn't accept that nobody had ever been able to solve it. It had destroyed many civilizations and was now becoming a global threat. And all the reasons for desertification that I was taught in university did not make sense in the field. For example, it was being blamed on too much livestock, but I was seeing desertification beginning severely in national parks with no livestock, in wilderness areas, on research plots, in research study plots and stations, past civilizations in the Americas that had no livestock, had been irrigation-based and low rainfall, and they had failed due to desertification with no livestock. So I was desperately trying to understand what was causing it, and the first clue I got was beginning to see much greater health of rivers, wildlife, land, soil, and everything where we had almost intact very large populations of buffalo, lechwe, you know, other animals with their predators, you know, where I could see more than 40 lions in a day just walking in the bush, and thousands of buffalo. Couldn't count the herds, they were too big. And I was seeing more healthy land there than I was when I got onto commercial ranches or farms or anything else. So that was the first clue, was seeing that there was some connection between the hooves and the behavior of large herbivores and the health of the land. And then as I studied it more and more, I began to realize that if you take away the pack hunting predators, the herbivore behavior changes, and then you start seeing riparian damage, soil damage, and everything. So as an example of that, years ago I gave a talk in Yellowstone National Park, and somebody in the audience asked me what could be done about all the riparian damage in the park being done by elk and deer and so on. And I said, there's nothing you can do about it in this park until you reintroduce a wolf, and then it will begin to solve itself. And about 30 years later, lo and behold, you know, wolves were back and researchers were recording the riparian areas beginning to improve. So the predator plays a very critical role in this, and that's why on our property in Africa, we do not kill the lions, the cheetah, the hyenas, the wild dogs. We have all of these predators, and we run the cattle in a predator-friendly manner, and we lose very few indeed ever to predators.
I guess I just don't quite understand, though. What do the predators do? Do they cause them to bunch up, and why is that important?
With increasing research, we'll understand it more and more. At this point, what we can understand is that they basically cause the animals to bunch, because the bunching is their best protection, and their other protection is dropping all their young in a very short period. That's with the main herding herbivores. And the bigger the bunch, the more afraid the predator is of the bunch. Now, once they are bunched like that, then they dung and urinate all over the ground, and most animals don't like to feed on their own feces, so they keep moving. And the movement was what prevented the overgrazing of plants causing any damage. But that's a fairly minor part of it. The biggest part of it, as I'm increasingly realizing, is the hooves cause the rainfall to become more effective, the hooves and the constant movement. So in Africa, where we're teaching communal lands, tribal people, we sort of come up with simple slogans like the hooves lead to more grass as the rainfall becomes more effective, etc.
Well, before we go into your techniques further, let's tell listeners about the potential to recapture carbon from the atmosphere. How much carbon has come from the soil? Is it significant? And how much could be returned there?
The carbon that we've got in the atmosphere, you can never go to a low-carbon economy. The whole world runs on carbon. Okay, and you've got ambient carbon in the air that needs to keep cycling through vegetation and so on. But we've got an excess load or legacy load from all the desertification, burning, soil destruction, and fossil fuel use. Okay, now, to get that carbon back out of the atmosphere, it can really only safely be done through the oceans or the land. And that means life, through biodiversity, life on the oceans and the land. Now, the oceans, it will require very long periods of rest, and to stop the excessive, ridiculous over-exploitation and even scraping the floor of oceans now for profit. And given time, they will recover, but the quicker we can do it, the quicker they can begin to recover. Now, on the land, most people, as you know, are pushing for the planting of trees. Well, that's a great idea, but first thing is it cannot stop desertification, because the desertification wasn't due to a lack of trees. And most countries, 80 or 90% of the land is below the rainfall that would support a full canopy of tree cover and thus a full soil cover. So the grasslands become the key to it. And the grasslands, the savannas, the man-made deserts constitute roughly about two-thirds of Earth's land surface. So it's by far the greatest part of the Earth. So that's where we need to concentrate most, although acting everywhere, that's where we need to concentrate most on sequestering the excess carbon load and stopping further carbon from getting into the air from the heating of the soil, soil destruction, biomass burning. Now, there are many people looking for different technologies to take carbon out of the air and sequester it somewhere, bury it deep in the soil or anything else. And many of those are good ideas, and they will have application in various places and times, but any technical solution like that always carries the danger of unintended consequences. And whole books have been written about the unintended consequences of technical fixes to problems in nature. So that's risky, but it certainly needs to keep being explored, but it'll always carry risk. And without any risk, we know that we can absorb all of the carbon legacy load in the grasslands of the world and the other agricultural soils. So that's the obvious thing to do, particularly when you consider that if we had some technique whereby we could take out all of the carbon legacy load in the atmosphere and put it somewhere guaranteed to be safe, you would still face climate change because of all the additional carbon being added every year from faulty agriculture. By the way, when I use the word agriculture, I'm referring to it not as croplands, but as the production of food and fiber from the land, the world's land and waters. That's what agriculture really is. It's not crop production.
This is EcoShock Radio. All environment, all the time. Get more info on the web at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our award-winning guest is biologist Alan Savory, founder of the Savory Institute. You've mentioned a couple of times the word holistic, and I think some people associate that with hippies or New Age people. They don't really know what it means. Could you quickly tell us about the origins and meaning of the holistic concept?
Okay, I use the word holistic to credit General Smuts. Jan Smuts, General Smuts, he was known as, was a botanist by love, a lawyer by profession, but a soldier and a statesman by force of circumstance. And he wrote the book Holism and Evolution in 1926, warning us scientists that we would never understand nature, and that is the whole role of science, is to understand nature. And he warned us that we would never understand it until we understood that nature only functioned in wholes and patterns. So I always go back to his original work, which was incredible and an amazing mind. And so I don't tend to work with theories like chaos and so on that have followed since, but prefer to credit the original person. And he coined the word holistic to try to describe a world functioning in which nature functions only in wholes, whole atoms, whole molecules, whole people, whole trees, whole communities, in patterns. And this is what science, reductionist science, is increasingly confirming. I believe we've had one major worldview shift, which was from a flat world to a round world, and that took about 400 years, and some people haven't made it yet. But we're in the beginning of the second major shift in worldview from a linear world, reductionist world, mechanistic world, whatever you like to call it, to a holistic worldview.
And after many years, there is a wave of support coming your way, Alan. What is going on with holistic land management in the United States and the so-called Brown Revolution?
Well, let me start with the Brown Revolution. Some time ago, I was shocked to hear that Bill Gates, although I fully accept his motive and he's a wonderful person trying to do a lot of good, announced that he was intending to support a new green revolution, and Warren Buffett's money was involved and the U.S. government was supporting it. And that actually horrified me because we've had one green revolution and we all know the results, the mixed results from that. And as I like to glibly put it, anybody can grow more green plants with hydroponics, high technology, a whole lot of things. The issue is soil, because everything is in the end dependent on soil and soil life. And if we look at agriculture today agriculture is producing more eroding soil than it is food. So we cannot sustain any economy, any nation, any civilization if we keep doing that. And climate change will continue even post-fossil fuels if we continue that. So that's the most frightening statistic there is in the world today, that agriculture is producing more eroding soil than food. So that's why I said, let's rather focus on a brown revolution, focus on the soil. Let's try to get the world focusing on what matters. Now, apart from the soil's importance in all these ways, you know we're fighting oil wars, and many wise people can see that we're going to fight water wars far more serious than oil wars, and the greatest reservoir of fresh water in the world is soil. It's not rivers and lakes. It's the soil. But we're making the rainfall less effective over most of the world through our agricultural practices, and so that water is going to oceans, lakes, etc., and not into the sponge that it should be in the soil. So there are a number of reasons why we need to focus on the soil.
As we move towards a conclusion, let us suppose humanity finally hears your message. If we went out into the Great Plains of Africa, South America, Australia, or North America, what would we see?
Well, you'll ultimately see, I'm just visioning here what I'd like to see if I could come back in years to come. You'll just see vast, healthy grasslands with covered soil between the plants, and just abundant wildlife, flowing rivers, and millions of livestock amongst that wildlife. There's no need for conflict. The conflict is the way people make their decisions and management today. We, on our place in Africa, have no conflict between the wildlife and the livestock as long as the livestock are run the right way. Now, it will take changing the way we run livestock. That is going to be essential because livestock, rightly, are vilified for causing so much of the problem. But that was not because of the livestock. It was because of the way people have managed them for centuries. And so it's essential that people understand we've got to change the way we manage livestock. And that's what we do through holistic planned grazing. So I envision in the future vast, wonderful savannas, grasslands full of people and life, but in which the livestock are run correctly, and they will produce it.
Alan Savory, how can people find out more about you and your work?
Well, the best is to get onto the website, Savory Institute, and that make people search for that. That's under review at the moment because things are moving so fast, but if people get onto it and then within a month, it'll be very changed, but that would be the best way.
And is there any final message you'd like to leave with our listeners? Anything you'd like to add?
No, just great that they're listening and interested, because only an informed public opinion can bring about change. Change can't come from governments, universities, environmental organizations. It can only come from a better, more well-informed public. So thank you for listening.
This is Radio EcoShock. You have been listening to a pioneer of the new land management and ways to recapture carbon from the overloaded atmosphere. Alan Savory is the founder and bright light at SavoryInstitute.com. Alan, thank you so much for sharing your life and your insight.
Well, thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith.